Welcome to Critical Readings, episode 77, for the 10th of May, 2021. I'm Dr. Cooper, and with me today I have just one panelist, but it's our good friend, Jack Tyler.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, Jack. We're not joined by Drew today, which is his first day off in a while, and he's certainly earned a respite. I believe he's out celebrating with family members. And you and I are catapulted here together to look at the works of Ben Jonson. But first, a very brief apology to our listeners. I know there was not an episode last week, and it was not possible due to difficult circumstances for me to notify you in advance. But if you are a reader of mine on Twitter, you'll know that my father died last Saturday at the age of 81. And I want to thank all of you for your enormous outpouring of support, well wishes, prayers, condolences, and sympathies. They've been an enormous help, and it helped sustain me and my family through a very difficult time. I really, really appreciate all of it. So thank you ever so much for that. And I'm really looking forward to cracking in to Ben Jonson. I often find the best thing for me is to keep busy. It was my father's attitude as well in the face of death. And so today we're going to get busy with one of the greats of English letters, Ben Jonson. And to kick us off on that, our good friend Jack has done some research and he knows quite a bit about the life of Jonson, don't you?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm an expert, but an enthusiastic amateur in studying Jonson. And the reason that
Jack, you must permit me. There's a pun in it.
Just a flatter.
I'm going to say it's a new and doubtless very different life of Jonson that we're about to hear.
Oh, yeah, a very different. There we are. Probably not a different Jonson and a much briefer life of Jonson. But my interest in Jonson, Critical Readers, was a sort of an algebraic one, a solving for X. So in many of the poets that we've covered, whether it's Donne or Herrick, we're sort of circling around Jonson, who is this titan of Jacobean and Caroline letters. But we haven't directly touched on Jonson. But of course, he's pretty foundational to understanding the drama and poetry of his time. So that's why I selected him, despite not being, having studied him in any particular detail. But I can tell you that he was born in 1572 in London. He was the son of a priest who died just a month before his son's birth, and he was stepfathered by a master bricklayer. And Jonson wanted to complete his university studies, but was unable to do so, and instead he kept the trade of bricklaying and continued to pay dues to the Bricklayers Guild, even at the height of his literary fame. He serves with the military in the Low Countries and famously slays an enemy in single combat, bringing back his enemy's armor and arms to the camp in true classical style. He is married to Anne Lewis in 1594. It is not a particularly happy marriage. He is imprisoned from 1604 to 1605 for supposedly anti-Scottish elements in his play Eastward Ho. This is not his first brush with the law.
Oh,
his connection with his lost play Isle of Dogs was considered lewd and slanderous, and Jonson does bear a brand on his hand with F for felon for his entire life. But this does not prevent him from having from enjoying quite a bit of literary fame, he is enormous influence throughout the court of James I. His masks are much enjoyed by the king, and perhaps it might be helpful for our readers to delineate the distinction between a play and a mask.
Yes.
And Yes,
they're both semi-dramatic works, of course, but yes, quite different.
Yes, they're both dramatic. Yes. So masks were they're typically performed for very select audiences, whereas plays were open to the public. A mask is something that would be performed for the court. There was a lot of emphasis on special effects, so to speak. Shakespeare's plays in their original staging would have been quite spare. There's the an emphasis on the actors, on their lines, costumes, and costume changes. Add a great degree of audience participation. So these nobles and courtiers would have danced during the masks. This is we don't have this sort of participation in you know, plays staged at the Globe. I don't think a nobleman would be caught dead on Shakespeare's stage.
Certainly not.
And so that is, and I think that difference between the masks and the masks in the plays, I think does helps us differentiate between, you know, someone like Jonson and Shakespeare, or Jonson and Donne, in that Jonson, you know, despite coming from this background of the trades and bricklaying and being very self-consciously self-made man, he was also someone who's dedicated to high art. And after the death of James the First, the masks sort of fall out of fashion. Jonson dies in 37 and is buried in Westminster Abbey, and his works in two volumes are published later in 1640. But that's a bit on Ben Jonson, and I believe to just jump into his verse, we're going to start with Epigram 11. So we're going chronologically through some of his poetry, and we're also going by increasing length. So are you ready for 11?
I am ready for 11. Take us away.
Okay. This is Epigram 11, and an epigram, critical readers, is something from Jonson's classical heritage. Jonson was a dedicated classicist, even though he didn't he was unable to complete his university studies. He was greatly enamored by Horace and Martial, and he thought that it was their verse, and it was classical precedence, classical symmetry, that ought to guide English letters. He was quite critical of the innovations and asymmetries of artists like Donne and Shakespeare. And epigrams are these sort of short, pithy bits of prose or verse that would be typically inscribed under monuments in the classical era. So that famous epigram or inscription that's laid at Thermopylae for the 300 Spartans, that would be a sort of prime example. And Jonson writes epigrams himself, and this is epigram number 11, titled On Something That Walks Somewhere. At court I met it, in clothes brave enough to be a courtier, in looks grave enough to seem a statesman. As I near it came, it made a great face. I asked the name. A lord, it cried, buried in flesh and blood, and such from whom let no man hope least good, for I will do none, and is little ill, for I will dare none. Good lord, walk dead still.
Thank you. That's quite clever. Now, why this epigram out of the very many that there are here?
Yes. I think this one is... this kind of encapsulates, I think, the spirit of Jonson and his work. If we look at it, there's a sort of a balance and a symmetry throughout it. So if we look at that last little couplet of these words spoken by the Lord, for I will do none and as little ill, for I will dare none. Good Lord, walk dead still. Mm-hmm. This courtier that Jonson encounters will do no good and will dare no evil. And this is the there's a kind of a pithiness and clarity and balance that the Greek and Roman authors valued, and that Johnson recreates in the English language. There's not the the kind of Baroque quality that we might find in someone like Donne, who likes to sort of take language and tease it and torture it, but rather here, simplicity and clarity and balance. And I also chose this one because I think it captures the position of a self-made man in the court. Johnson was a bricklayer by trade, and he was a large man. He weighed 20 stone, and he went about in a he didn't go about in sort of French finery. He went about in a leather tote in which he had cut slits in the armpit to better ventilate his rather large self. So I think that he is a devotee of classical studies and the courtly art. But he also is a bit of misfit at the court. He's a brawler. He's killed at least one man, a frequenter of taverns, a convicted felon. So he is a bit of a misfit among, I think, some sort of the silken finery of the court. And we see this in Epigram 11, in that he doesn't quite fit in with these other courtiers, but why would he want to? I mean, they're sort of dead and dull on the inside. They will do no good and dare no evil.
Yeah. So what do they do? Neither good nor evil. Nothing, I suppose. Trivial things.
Right, right. Yeah. So that is the epigram that I chose as an introduction to Johnson, because it does so neatly encapsulate his art and art and life.
I quite like the way that it deals with ambiguity and a lack of clarity, right? The whole epigram seems to revolve around an inability to pin down, from the title, on something that walks somewhere, right? This, not even a specific, thing or place. And then in the body, we also have the speaker's attempt to get at some sort of precision. What is he encountering? What does it do? And is frustrated at every attempt, right? It's not even clear that it's a courtier, hence the title on something. It clothes brave enough to be a courtier and looks grave enough to seem a statesman, possibly one or the other, but it's unclear which. And then he tries to get a name, right? As I near it came, it made me a great face. I asked the name. A lord, it cried, buried in flesh and blood. Well, yes, but that's not a name. That's a quality, right? Or a position. There are many types of lords. There are lords that hold positions in state. There are lords that are courtiers. There are lords that are just lords. There are lords that sit in the House of Lords and aren't necessarily lords at all. So, what kind of lord? Well, the kind that does neither good nor evil. Then we have that final quip: "Good Lord, walk dead still." Right. Sort of, is that the Lord speaking it, or is it Johnson rendering judgment on this, something that walks somewhere but doesn't seem to do, right? Hence walk dead, do nothing, but walk about. It's a wonderful thing. And it suggests, I think, a degree of sharpness on Johnson's part. Possibly because it also follows an epigram that is rather critical of a lord who does get a name. Epigram 10, which is a single couplet. "Thou call'st me poet as a term of shame, but I have my revenge made in thy name." You might say, what do you mean in thy name? Well, the name of the epigram is "To my lord ignorant." Right? Mm-hmm. So, he's a poetic broadside, or at least a single salvo, perhaps, being only a couplet. So I get the sense here that Johnson is somewhat self-conscious of these pompous, self-aggrandizing courtiers and lords with whom he must engage, and who don't appear to do anything, neither good nor ill. They can't even be pinned down as to whom they are, right? They are kind of ambiguous in their clothing. Are they statesmen? Are they courtiers? What do they do exactly? It reminds me of that moment in that old classic comedy film Office Space, where the one of the fellows is dragged in.
The interview.
Says, "What do you do here?"
What do you do here? Well,
I'm a people person.
And I think that I think that there's a point here that, you know, success in any kind of elite circle, a lot of it depends on conformity and seeming harmless, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a, you know, if you walk around Washington, D.C., for example, I mean, just the sheer number of blue blazers and immaculate haircuts is enough to drive one mad. And, you know, and at a certain point, I think elite persons, they tend to adopt not only a similarity in dress, but a kind of a similarity in speech and manners. There's all the at the inner circle of any sort of institution, there's not only an unofficial uniform, but usually an unofficial sort of code of language and jargon that gets used. Mm. So there's yeah, I remember talking with Drew about his attending a conference in composition, and how about every other presentation either had the word identity used or the word subversive, right? So at high levels of, you know, whether it's in academia or government,
you need a sort of bingo card whenever you attend these conferences.
Just repeat these little shibboleths. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A bingo card. Yeah.
Says, that says things like identity, disrupt. That's another very popular one. Or always, what is it? Almost always or always becoming, you know, things like that sort of things. They are shibboleths, but they're also code, right? They're a way of signifying that you have knowledge of the ritualistic practices that define elite conduct, right? And this is always being created. It's been like this pretty much forever. And I think we see Johnson kind of frustrated with that.
Pretty much always, yeah.
Right, like saying, "Well, look, this is nonsense." These people can't be pinned down on anything. You can't even get a name out of them. And what do? They nothing. They do nothing.
Yeah. So I think while, you know, and I think while Johnson would have had, you know, he's a brawler, a convicted felon. He's from the trade. So I think while he has reasons to be sort of self-conscious and a bit of a misfit at the court, I mean, why would he want to fit in?
Exactly. Right? He's a doer anyway, right?
He's a doer. That's right. He has dared to do both good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Just to survive.
Well, shall we move on to the next, which is our...
Would you like to read it?
Sure. Let me grab it here. So we have a slightly longer poem now. This is written to John Donne. And they knew each mm-hmm. other, of course. I'm sure we've discussed this before with Drew. We were talking about the metaphysical poets and the divide that exists between the metaphysical poets and other poets of the period. And we looked at both sides of that divide. So here's Johnson writing to Donne. Donne was older than Johnson, wasn't he? Yeah.
Let's see. So Johnson is born in, I believe, 1572. And I don't know. I they've got to be pretty close. They're both born in 1572.
Oh, there you go. Look at the same age.
Okay.
Done same age. January, yeah. 1572. So they would have been men of a similar era. So here's what Ben mm-hmm. Johnson says to John Donne in this lovely poem. Donne, the delight of Phoebus and each muse, who to thy one all other brains refuse, whose every work of thy most early wit came forth example and remains so yet, longer unknowing than most wits do live, and which no affection praise enough can give, to it thy language, letters, arts, best life, which might with half mankind maintain a strife, all which I meant to praise, and yet I would but leave, because I cannot as I should. So Johnson clearly a strong supporter of the work of Donne here, and some very clever, indeed witty rhymes. I particularly like muse and refuse. That's quite good in that mm-hmm. first couplet. The delight of Phoebus and each muse who to thy one all other brains refuse. Phoebus and all the muses would rather be with Donne than anyone else, and they have deserted the rest of humanity so that they can reside in Dunn's brain alone. So that gives you an idea of how greatly Johnson esteems Dunn.
And I like this bit on Dunn, because even though Johnson both greatly esteemed Dunn and Shakespeare, he was also an ardent critic of both of these artists. So if Johnson is willing to do both good and both evil, he's willing to both criticize and praise. So he does, I think, have a lot of reservations about witty poetry. So that idea that a kind of bit of principle or wisdom can be teased out of everyday objects like a flea, for example.
Mm-hmm. Burns.
And I think that he does have some objections to that, which I think are registered in this poem. He says that, Dunn, you are longer in knowing than most wits do live. So I think there's a bit of a oblique criticism of some of Dunn's earlier work. And Johnson is famous for telling his literary confidant and friend Drummond that Dunn was the first in world and first poet in the world in many things. But he also tells Drummond that he thinks that Dunn is redeemed by his repenting of some of his earlier poetry. And Dunn as a priest and public figure does distance himself from quite a bit of his early work. So I think that Johnson's praise here to John Dunn is still qualified, and that he offers some slight and indirect criticism of Dunn's early work, but also praises him for outliving his witty youth.
I think it's quite good, and I'm glad you pointed out that he was at times a frequent critic of Dunn. I think it shows that Johnson was capable of being very equanimous about the writings of others, right? He, in the previous poems, from the epigrams, we get a sense of, self-conscious Ben Johnson, a bit aggrieved, by the sort of classist nature of, courtier and political life in England. But here, I think in this poem about Dunn, we get a sense that, you know, he's not some sort of terminally aggrieved person. In fact, he's an astute judge of poetry, and he's willing to tell his friends when their poetry isn't very good. And he's also willing to praise them for their capacities and for those works which are particularly exceptionable. And that makes him, I think, a good man to have on your side, because he's going to make you a better poet. He's not just going to tell you that everything is good, and he's not going to be an enemy. He's just going to tell you that everything you read is garbage. He will praise the good, but also critique the evil, right? So certainly, and I think we'll see this later on in another poem that's upcoming. It's worth remembering that Johnson was involved in the production of the first folio. He knew what was good, and not only did he know it, he championed it when it was good. And he was very highly regarded in the press and amongst the readers of the day. So he's a kind of almost like a T.S. Eliot or an Ezra Pound figure, right? With his with his finger on the pulse of, you know, what is great in English letters, and not just, you know, polite, not just privately, but publicly, making every effort that he could to champion those authors and those works.
That's good. That's good. And I think there's in his attitude towards Dunn and being forthright in his criticism and forthright in his praise. I think we get a bit of the also the blue collar sensibilities, if you will, of Johnson. And reflecting on my interactions with men and sort of other young men in the collegiate and graduate school settings, you know, versus my interaction with my peers that I've had in the world of industrial and ranching and construction work, there's a I think a kind of directness to the blue collar or working man that you just don't see in the sort of collegiate or grad school-y circles. The same men that want to fight you one week are going to, you know, stay late to help you the next.
Absolutely.
And I think you can see that in Johnson, a kind of a forthrightness and honesty, about him. There's not that, there's not anything sort of hidden or calculating in his praise or criticism.
Well, thank you for that. Shall we move on to this invitation?
I think so.
And can I invite you to read the invitation?
Yes, certainly, certainly. So this is inviting a. This is also from the Epigrams. Inviting a friend to supper tonight, grave sir. Both my poor house and I do equally desire your company. Not that we think us worthy such a guest, but that your worth will dignify our feast. With those that come, whose grace may make it that seem something which else could hope for no esteem. It is the fair acceptance, sir, creates the perfect entertainment. Not the cates yet shall you have to rectify your palate. An olive, capers, or some better salad. Ushering the mutton with a short-legged hen, if we can get her full of eggs and then lemons and wine for sauce. To these, a coney is not yet to be despaired of for our money. And though fowl be now scarce, yet there are clerks. The sky not falling, think we may have larks. I'll tell you of more and lie, so you will come, of partridge, pheasants, woodcock, of which some may yet there be, and goodwit, if we can, gnat, rail, and ruff too. Howsoe'er, my man, shall we read a piece of Virgil, Tacitus, Livy, or some better book to us, of which we'll speak our minds amidst our meat, and I'll profess no verses to repeat. To this, if aught appear which I know not of, that will the pastry, not my paper, show off. Digestive cheese and fruit there sure will be, but that which most doth take my muse and me is a pure cup of rich canary wine, which is the mermaid's now, but shall be mine, of which had Horace or Anacreon tasted their lives, as so their lines till now had lasted. Tobacco, nectar, or the Thespian spring are all but Luther's beer. To this I sing. Of this will I sup free, but moderately, and we will have no pulley or parrot by, nor shall our cups make any guilty men. But at our parting, we will be as when we innocently met. No simple word that shall be uttered at our mirthful board shall make us sad next morning or fright the liberty that we'll enjoy tonight.
Sounds a very jolly sort of evening. Mm-hmm. You get a nice meal, and then you get a bumper of ardent spirits to help wash it all down, and some fruit and cheese. Mm-hmm. It sounds extremely jolly, and it makes me hungry. I'd love some salad ushering in the mutton, as it were, with a short-legged hen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is a poem that Johnson writes after one of his sort of great dead mentors in literature, the famous Roman epigrammist Martial. Mm-hmm. So this is I'll read a translation from Martial's I believe it's his 78th epigram to Turanius.
Okay.
And Martial writes, "If you are suffering from a dread of a melancholy dinner at home, Turanius, you may come and fast with me. If you're in the habit of taking a preparatory wet, you'll experience no want of common Cappadocian lettuces and strong leeks. The tunny will lurk under slices of egg, a cauliflower hot enough to burn your fingers, and which has but left the cool garden will be served freehand green on a black platter, while sausages will float on snow-white porridge, and the pale bean will accompany the red-streaked bacon. If you know the riches of a second course, raisins will I set before you, and pears which pass for Syrian, and chestnuts to which learned Naples gave birth, roasted at a slow fire. The wine you will prove in drinking it." I think Johnson is, of course, in this poem, paying a bit of tribute to his classical classical roots, and there's the and of course at this classical meal they're going to read a bit of classical verse, Virgil, Tacitus, or Livy, or some better book to us. And the better book could perhaps be the Bible. We also see this this idea that a social meal should be accompanied by verse. If we remember, Robert Herrick, he invites his readers to read his own poems at the dinner table. And I was also intrigued by the reference to the mermaid. And Dr. Cooper, can you tell us a little bit about the significance of the mermaid?
Well, in the Elizabethan era, a mermaid meant a variety of things, but it was usually used as a euphemism for prostitutes. So I was a little perplexed to see it here. Indeed, when Mary, Queen of Scots, ended up shacking up with the man who assassinated her husband, she was depicted as a mermaid, and she was thrust at a window before the populace with her breasts exposed, and they held her up to great derision and scorn. That's why she fled Scotland. It's worth remembering she didn't end up in England for fun. She had to flee her own country because her people turned against her, and she was depicted as a mermaid because when her husband was murdered, the fellow who was responsible, the Earl of Bothwell, I believe. Her husband had been the Lord Darnley, if I recall correctly. But feel free to correct me. I'm doing this from memory here. So she married the Lord Darnley, and then the Earl of Bothwell, who wanted to be the King of Scotland, bumped him off, strangled him in his garden. And then he took Mary by force, and so it is said. And then she married him after this. That was just too much for the populace to handle. So they depicted her as a mermaid, a prostitute for, marrying this man who it was said had raped her and had murdered her husband.
Well,
so
and
we see it here, right? This idea of a deplorable creature by estimations.
Right. And that may take us a bit far afield. Johnson was Scottish by descent. Mm-hmm. He came from a family of infamous reavers along the borderlands. He had an outlaw's build at 20 stone. But I was thinking, Dr. Schubert, more of the famous Mermaid's Tavern, where Absolutely. Many authors of the day would have met. So, Johnson and Donne and others, frequented, the Mermaid Tavern. This was, a place where, literary greats, would have come. Christopher Marlowe Absolutely. As well. He was actually murdered in a tavern brawl. It could have been the mermaid.
It could have been. And as I understand, the Mermaid's Tavern had something of a dubious reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think the name does a good job of also symbolizing that, right? Like this sort of quasi... is it just a symbol? Is it mythological, or is there something seedier going on here? Mm. Right.
So it could have been the scene of prostitution. This place where esteemed men of letters like Johnson, Shakespeare, Donne,
indeed
Marlowe would have hung out.
It's worth remembering they weren't the Shakespeare, the Johnson that were there aren't really the sort of like we kind of imagine them today as like busts almost, right? They're immaculate. They're the men at the height of English letters, but they were real human beings, and they had their faults, and they weren't always. And then they were men of the theater, which was not the most well-regarded profession by any measure.
No,
right.
Well, and I think Johnson would rather remember himself as a man of the mask.
Yeah,
but they both Johnson and Shakespeare were both self-made men who came through the courts from rather humble.
Yeah, it was a rough and tumble London of the day. It was not polished and refined, and these were not polished and refined men, although they certainly had a mastery of the language which surpasses even the most refined courtier. They were that, also, swarthy and men of the earth in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tobacco and nectar. Or the thespian spring, or all but Luther's beer. To this, I sing. Their inspiration, King the Muses here. He's invoking beer and tobacco.
Yeah, the pipe and the bottle
as the inspirations for the poet. yeah, the pipe and the bottle. It's the working man's muses. He doesn't seem to have the to come about his poetry in other ways. And there's also the he also says, we'll sup free but moderately, and we'll have no pulley or parrot by. And these are most likely references to two government spies who would have been in that same as Christopher Marlowe, and they probably would have been present at Marlowe's murder in one of these taverns. So the dinner that that Johnson is inviting his friend to, he's saying, well, it's going to be a rather it's going to be a working man's dinner in a sort of rowdy tavern, but I can you know, at least promise that there's no spies. no spies nearby. Nor shall our cups make any guilty men. The mermaid was of course frequented by of course great men of letters, but also by spies, and sometimes by men of letters who were spies.
Indeed. William Cecil, who was Elizabeth the First's spy master to a great degree, he had men everywhere. And there was a sort of early modern police state almost. So great was the fear of Catholic rebellion. So there were spies continuously. And also they were worried about foreign powers too. They were greatly concerned about Holland and Spain for that matter. There's a certain sense in which we can almost imagine Johnson, Shakespeare, and Marlowe as being almost like rubbing shoulders with the James Bond of their day, right? These are the... Mm-hmm. You know, they're suave and debonair. I mean, one looks at that picture reputed to be a Shakespeare with his high collar and his earring. Marlowe was certainly a sort of dashing but dangerous figure. There's a way in which they do seem almost like sort of Elizabethan, you know, secret agents. Although to the degree to which that any of that they were engaged in political stuff is dubious at best, but they certainly would have rubbed shoulders or encountered in their lives men who were engaged on the Queen's business, and not always in the nice, restrained way, but sometimes involving torture and murder. There are people who say that that's what happened to Marlowe. The details of his murder are still today somewhat unclear.
Somewhat unclear. Mm-hmm. And I was interested. I wonder if that's a reference in in line 37 of the poem, "Nor shall cups make any guilty men." But at our parting, we will be as when we innocently met. I wonder if that's a reference to the Last Supper.
Yeah.
So Mary, if that's there
That's a great idea.
So if there are spies here at the possibly spies here at the Mermaid Tavern, they're sort of like Judas, right? There's a spy at the table of Jesus, but Johnson assures us no, that won't be happening.
It also warns about the content, right? We're not going to be discussing anything, you know, untoward. This is not a gathering for political purposes. We're just getting together to talk about Roman history. And don't worry, he tells us, I won't bore you with my poetry. We're going to focus on the historians, which I think is a very – he must know his audience to whom this is. Perhaps his audience isn't a poet, but a historian. So he's promising Livy and Tacitus.
Yeah, and I think, while there is, I think, a sort of a mirthful face to the poem, this sort of reference to the mermaid and the network of spies that circulated through it. I think that that can complexifies what would otherwise be a simple invitation to a working man's dinner.
It's an explanation of the circumstances, which is couched in the language of poetry. And that, you know, once you start to strip away the layers of poetry, you begin to see that this is, you know, sort of an encouragement that is combined with reassurance, right? Don't worry. We know there are spies around, but we're not going to be discussing anything that will get anyone in any trouble. And also, you should know what kind of place this is that we're going. You know, it's not going to be, you know, a courtier's dinner with poetry and refined. We're going to be talking about more earthy things, and then we're going to drink a lot for a very long time. And then we will turn out into the street.
That's right.
Well, one parting thing is I do like that he puts the onus of the success of the evening in the response, the expected response of the recipient. It's a very clever rhetorical maneuver, right? This whole thing can only succeed, will only be worthwhile if the invitee accepts. And we have this wonderful line, which so beautifully does this. It seems so gracious, but is also somewhat manipulative. He says, something, I'm sorry, it says, it is the fair acceptance, sir, creates the entertainment perfect. The fair acceptance creates the entertainment perfect. Not the actual event itself, but the politeness of the reply, accepting the invitation. So if you're ever trying to get someone to attend your party, remember to include that line.
And I wonder if that's an idea that he draws from Marshall, because if we go back to the epigram to Turanius, Marshall tells his friend, the wine you will prove in drinking it.
Exactly.
He does put the onus of the worthiness of this rather kind of humble dinner of leeks and lettuces upon the recipient.
Well, if you're ever writing a dinner invitation, I think you could do worse than to borrow a snatch of a line here and there from Marshall or Johnson. I would be persuaded. We have one more. And this is from the miscellany. And since we've mentioned Shakespeare and Marlowe and the other great figures of the day, I think it's only fitting to end with Johnson's poem on the memory of Shakespeare. As I mentioned earlier, we owe a great debt of gratitude to Johnson, not only for championing the works of Shakespeare in the press of the day, but in publishing the works of Shakespeare. Johnson was amongst the editors who put together the First Folio, which is like the primary source for many of Shakespeare's plays. And it's extremely vital. And without it, many of them would have been lost to history. We perhaps wouldn't know much of Shakespeare at all. He would perhaps be to us the same way that, say, Thomas Kidd is to us, right? So many of them would be lost. He might be a figure perhaps as important as Marlowe. Another
Who's Thomas Kidd?
Thomas Kidd, yes. The playwright Thomas Kidd. And also Sir Anthony Mundy.
Yeah. Who's that? Oh, I guess that's the case in point.
Yeah, well, there you go. See, nobody knows, right? So Thomas Kidd, he was a contemporary of Shakespeare. And indeed, it is said that he collaborated with Shakespeare on a few works. Let me see. Double Falsehood. I think that's Thomas Kidd. Possibly Sir Thomas More. That might be Sir Thomas Kidd as well. So he was a playwright. And not a very well-known one. And not a particularly good one. So if you read Double Falsehood, there are parts that are thought to be written by Shakespeare, and they show signs of brilliance. And then there are the parts that are written by Thomas Kidd. And, you know, it's serviceable, but it's not Hamlet, right? Not even close.
Right. Well, and critical readers, if there's a lesson to be gleaned here, it's that if you aspire to a literary legacy, you must not only write things that are good, but you must find a critics who are tough but fair-minded.
Exactly. And who will champion your cause. It's very important. We might not have Eliot were it not for Pound. Remember that, right? So these, and if you ever do become successful, remember that you also have a duty, therefore, to champion the work of others, because, you know, that's the job of the great critic. We kind of disparage the critic these days, and, you know, rightly so. There's a point at which the critic becomes self-important, and we don't want that. But the critic is does have an important role in, you know, helping to winnow out the wheat and the chaff, as it were. Well, here we go. Here's Johnson letting us know that Shakespeare is not chaff. To the memory of my beloved, the author, Mr. William Shakespeare, and what he hath left us. To draw no envy, Shakespeare, on thy name, am I thus ample to thy book and fame. Well, I confess thy writings to be such as neither man nor muse can praise too much. 'Tis true, and all men's suffrage, but these ways were not the paths I meant unto thy praise. For Celius' ignorance on these made light, which, when it sounds at best, but echoes right. Or blind affection, which doth ne'er advance the truth, but gropes and urgeth all by chance. Or crafty malice might pretend this praise, and think to ruin where it seemed to raise. These are, as some infamous bawd or whore should praise a matron, what could hurt her more? But thou art proof against them, and indeed above the ill fortune of them or the need. I therefore will begin. Soul of the age, the applause, delight, the wonder of our stage. My Shakespeare, rise. I will not lodge thee by Chaucer or Spenser or bid Beaumont lie. A little further to make thee a room. Thou art a monument without a tomb, and art alive still while thy book doth live, and we have wits to read and praise to give. That I not mix thee so, my brain excuses, I mean with great but disproportioned muses. For if I thought my judgment were of years, I should commit thee surely with thy peers, and tell how far thou didst our Lily outshine, or sporting Kid, or Marlowe's mighty line. And though thou hadst small Latin and less Greek, from thence to honor thee, I would not seek for names, but call forth thundering Aeschylus, Euripides, and Sophocles to us, Pacuvius, Achaeus, him of Cordova dead, to life again, to hear thy buskin tread, and shake a stage. Nor when thy socks were on, leave thee alone, for the comparison of all that insolent Greece or haughty Rome sent forth, or since did from their ashes, come. Triumph, my Britain, thou hast one to show, to whom all scenes of Europe homage owe. He was not of an age, but for all time, and all the muses still were in their prime, when like Apollo he came forth to warm our ears, or like a Mercury to charm. Nature herself was proud of his designs, and joyed to wear the dressing of his lines, which were so richly spun and woven so fit, as since she will vouchsafe no other wit. The merry Greek, tart Aristophanes, neat Terence, witty Plautus, now not please, but antiquated and deserted lie, as they were not of nature's family. Yet must I not give nature all? Thy art, my gentle Shakespeare, must enjoy a part. For though the poet's matter nature be, his art doth give the fashion, and that he who casts to write a living line must sweat, such as thine are, and strike the second heat upon the muse's anvil, turn the same, and himself with it, that he thinks to frame. Or for the laurel he may gain a scorn, for a good poet's made as well as born. And such wert thou. Look how the father's face lives in his issue. Even so, the race of Shakespeare's mind and manners brightly shines in his well-turned and true-filled lines, in each of which he seems to shake a lance as brandished at the eyes of ignorance. Sweet swan of Avon, what a sight it were to see thee in our waters yet appear, and make those flights upon the banks of Thames that so did take Eliza and our James. But stay, I see thee in the hemisphere advanced and made a constellation there. Shine forth, thou star of poets, and with rage or influence chide or cheer the drooping stage, which, since thy flight from hence, hath mourned like night, and despairs day, but for thy volume's light. Well, if you thought his praise of Donne was effusive, it's hard to imagine anyone being praised more highly and more eloquently than Shakespeare in that ode, really, by Johnson. And having read it, it's such a heartfelt piece that even removed by centuries from the language that Johnson uses, you can still hear and feel the absolute devotion and wonder that Shakespeare encouraged in his peers. We think of him as being sort of like the pinnacle of English letters, at a sort of revered place, almost like Moses, untouchable, high up on the mountain. But they knew him and loved him nevertheless. They revered him greatly, even though, you know, he was just an approachable person. He drank with them in the tavern, right? He cavorted with them at the Mermaid. He perhaps got up to some unseemly things, and yet still, look at the esteem that Johnson just totally sets him apart. And yes, some of it is a poetic commonplace, part of the ode, but I don't think you can come away from reading that and think that it's just convention and just say, well, you know, he was dead and this is what you do when somebody dies. You know, you talk about how great they were and how apart from humanity they stood. This is more than convention. I think there's something very genuine here. Johnson knew that Shakespeare was not merely a once in a century, but perhaps a once in a civilization kind of poet, a modern Homer. And he recognized it, which takes a degree of wit.
Yeah. Or someone who is not just a modern day Homer, but someone who completely displaces the Greeks and Romans. Of all that insolent Greece or haughty Rome sent forth, or since did from their ashes come, triumph, my Britain, thou hast one to show, to whom all the scenes of Europe homage owe. So from the ashes of Greek and Roman letters that are rediscovered in the Renaissance arises this phoenix of Shakespeare.
And indeed, after Shakespeare, the Greeks who had once, you know, delighted the stage now are deserted, as Johnson says, right? They can no longer please. Mm-hmm. Certainly, he had read Aristophanes, Terence, and Plautius, but after Shakespeare, no one seems interested in those. They want to see Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. And so if all the poets before him are sort of voided, or all the playwrights before him, their work is sort of made void. Johnson says that all the stage which since thy flight from hence hath mourned like night and despairs day, but for thy volume's light. I think. There's some truth to what Eliot said when he claimed that Shakespeare had exhausted the genre of the play.
Yeah. And I think that Johnson's comment there is still true, right? It's hard to imagine a stage that Shakespeare isn't on, right? Mm-hmm. It's as if everything, no matter how wonderful it is or how new or how inventive it is just so much of an intermission before the next Shakespeare play is put on, right? So you go to your local theater and you'll see they're putting on, perhaps they're doing some musicals, right? They'll do some Gilbert and Sullivan, Capital, right? Part of the standard repertoire. That'll bring the people out. Maybe they'll do some modern American musicals, maybe some Rodgers and Hammerstein or something like that, some Oklahoma or Carousel or something like that. But all of this is so much intermission before you look through the playbill and you see, coming in September, Macbeth, right? Mm-hmm. That's what makes it a real theater. And without that, I mean, it's still theater, right? And it's nice and you can go and you can have a good time, but there seems to be something missing. That's like the heart isn't there. But once Macbeth is being shown and you know that they're going to do some Shakespeare theater, it stops being community theater, amateur theater, it becomes theater with a capital T. Mm. Somehow it justifies everything else. And I think that's kind of what Johnson's getting at here when he says, you know, it despairs day, but for thy volume's light. Like there's other wonderful things out there, but the stage is just uninterested in it. It wants Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. As do we, right? There are people who continue to insist, he's only important because of, you know, systemic patriarchy, ingrained, yada, yada, yada. It's nonsense, really. You know, Johnson isn't benefiting from sustained patriarchy. He's not being subjected to centuries of taste formation. He knew Shakespeare personally and saw him on stage with his contemporaries and judged him, quite rightly, to be better than anything else going. And he wasn't the only one who thought this. Everyone thought this. It was a truth universal. You'd have to be out of your mind to contradict it. And that is the sort of affectation that can only be, you know, reinforced today in our deranged age. Certainly no one at the time would have thought such a thing.
Well, and I don't really think that Shakespeare or Johnson occupy the pinnacles of privilege. I mean, this is a bricklayer writing the praises of I believe, a poacher.
Yeah.
Shakespeare was famously caught for poaching.
These were not the elite.
Mm-mm, no,
they had not
no,
come neither, from the elite.
And neither of them, even though Johnson was unable to finish his university education and Shakespeare never undertook one. They were both kind of ciphers, before they ciphers in terms of their social merit. Mm. And their only recognition came from the merit of their work and their competences as writers.
What could be more equitable, right, than to be judged purely on the basis of what you can accomplish and for no other reason? And I think we see that with all of them, right? With Johnson and Marlowe and Kidd and Shakespeare, it was their achievements alone which earned them stature. Marlowe certainly by personality and reputation. If that had been the measure of his judgment, he would be consigned to obloquy. We wouldn't remember him, right? He was not a great, lovely person. He was a dangerous man and got himself killed for it. But he wrote remarkable things. Really, really remarkable. And Shakespeare, similarly, you know, kind of a nondescript figure, but what a pen. And Johnson could tell, and I think that's the what we have to remember here, is that Johnson, for all of his accomplishment, he was an incredible judge of aesthetic brilliance. For a man who did not finish his university education, if there's anyone out there who has not completed or has not undertaken a university education, you know, get a picture of Johnson and put it in your study or in your living room. And remember that an education is not necessary to be one of the most astute judges of what is good. And there's a great, there's a prevailing sense in our climate of credentialism that you really have to have an education and you really have to be a critic in order to know what's good or bad. And that's just nonsense. It's just complete nonsense. Johnson proves it. If you read enough, you don't need the education. The education can help, but it's unnecessary in the, in the strict sense.
And I think this nicely contrasts Epigram 11, the which is
look what credentialism Johnson, gets you, right?
Right. Johnson looking down on the person who's you know, all credentials and all pedigree and no substance, you know, versus Shakespeare, who is a nobody but accomplished so much.
Exactly. You know, one of them is an empty vessel that does nothing, right? Does no good, does no ill, doesn't even have a name, right? Can't be pinned down in anything. And, you know, is just so much hot air. And then there's Shakespeare, right? Who is just all doing. He is his work. His work is what he is. They're inseparable. And one lives forever and the other is just so much wind. Well, thank you for this wonderful voyage through some selections by Johnson. And I hope that it will encourage our listeners to go out and read some Johnson, because there's so much more than this little taster that we've provided. And quite a lot of it is available online. There's, you know, Project Gutenberg. You can get all sorts of Johnson. And I have a little, it's a slim volume, Harvard University Press, 1968, entitled The Muses Library, Poems of Ben Johnson, for which I paid, I think, all of $5. And it's got everything. It's got all of Johnson in it. Wouldn't you like to have that? It's a great time to buy poetry, people. Yeah. It's inexpensive.
For $5, I found the Norton Critical Edition of Johnson and the Cavalier Poets.
Excellent.
This one was published in 1974.
There you go. See, and there's never been a better time. I'm convinced in all human history, there has never been a better time to be an appreciator of printed poetry, because we live in an era where it's not very well valued. So you can get enormous quantities of beautifully printed bound poetry for nothing. You can build a poetry library at home, and I mean like a library running in the order of like 100 volumes for a couple $100. You don't have to do it all at once, right? You do $5 here, $5 there, and soon you're sitting on a library of poetry that you can pass down to your children, that you can read by the fireside. When your friends come over, you can share a poem, and when you read it, it will furnish your mind. Right, it provides the furniture of a mind, and you'll find these things coming to you. Just one brief anecdote. One doesn't want to wax self-obsessive here, but when my father died, the night before he died, I was at the hospital with him during the day, and I had mostly sat with him. And my father was a great one for telling stories, and I regret that I'm not very good at telling stories, and I'm not doing this one a great deal of justice either. Nevertheless, my father and his brothers are great at telling stories, and I told my dad, I think he could hear me, but he couldn't speak. He was kind of asleep, as it were. I said, I wish I had some stories to tell you, Dad, but I don't. You know, I was never very good at that. But I have poetry to tell you. So I read some poetry to him from my mind, and I quoted, I read Paul Revere's Ride to him. I say read, but I recited would be a better way. I recited Paul Revere's Ride, and I recited The Song of the Wandering Angus by Yeats, and Excelsior by Longfellow. But when I came back to the hospital that last day, that Friday before he died, I took with me a slim volume that I have of Idylls of the King in 12 books. Mm. And I read the entire The Passing of Arthur to my father. All of it, beginning to end. There was no one else in the room. My sister had to go out. So it was just me and him. And that was the last thing I did for him. As I said, you know, I don't have a great story to tell you, but I'm going to tell you a story you've probably never heard before. And this is the story that got me into literature. I'm going to read this poem by Tennyson to you. I said, it's probably not the stories you're used to about, my dad really liked Westerns, you know, about cowboys and Indians and things like that. But I think you might be able to understand what this is getting at and why it was so important for me to take this degree when I read this poem to you, because this poem means a great deal to me. And it's about the end of things, but also the beginning of things. So I read The Passing of Arthur, and it was tough to get through the end because, of course, Arthur dies in The Passing of Arthur, and my father was dying in front of me. But when my father died that evening, my mind immediately went back to that poem. And there's a line Bedivere says. He says, the poem reads, and Bedivere again quoted the weird rhyme, from the great deep to the great deep he goes. And that was the immediate line that came to my mind. And I think I'll probably always remember that with my father and with that poem. And that's what I mean by talking about the furniture of your mind. The only way that line could come into my mind is because I'd read it. And it gave me immense comfort to think about that poem's optimistic view of the future in the face of death, in the face of what seems to be the collapse of one's values, beliefs, society, civilization. Bedivere is facing the end of everything. The Round Table is dead. Arthur is dead. Camelot is dead. England, as he knows it, is dead. And there's no one to take its place, just a void. And, you know, Bedivere facing this calamity, we would expect to be overwhelmed with despair. But instead, the poem ends optimistically. And it says, you know, the new sun brought in the dawning of a new year, because it occurs on the last day of the year. And, you know, the sun rises and it's the 1st of January and it's a new beginning. Poetry can do that. It can give you that furnishing of the mind. It can give you these ideas and these thoughts articulated by the greatest who have ever lived. And they can be there for you when you need them most. And so that is why I say buy poetry. Sit down and actually read the Johnson. Don't just, you know, listen to critical readings, though we appreciate it. But go out and find the poets and others that we mention and read them. And they will be there for you when you need them in times of joy and sorrow, triumph and despair. Please, now is the time to do this. We don't get any cut. This is me giving you good life advice, unbidden perhaps, but nevertheless good. So I hope you will take us up on this offer and read some poetry.
We found that the Ben Johnson estate is actually rather stingy with royalties.
Indeed. They don't, we've been in touch, but the most I could get was half a guinea. All right. Well, that concludes our episode on Johnson. And we have one more from Jack before we move on to our big summer read through of the Canterbury Tales. So I hope you're excited for that, because I'm properly excited for reading the Canterbury Tales. I love Chaucer. We might point out, got to mention that Johnson rates Shakespeare above Chaucer and Spenser for that matter. And I think justly so. So who's the last of your trifecta of authors for us, Jack?
I'm taking a bit of a curveball, a bit of a populist pick. I'd like to read some of the verse of Rudyard Kipling.
Excellent. I'm really excited about this. Of course, any of our British readers will know If, right? It's a standard part of the British curriculum, but there's so much more there to read. And next week, we will certainly read If, of course. Right? It's an essential work, but we'll read some more as well. So if is the only thing you know by Kipling, definitely tune in next week and broaden your Kipling horizon. And thank you to Jack for selecting him.
Well, yeah, thank you for having me for this recording.
We will be back in a week with an episode on Kipling. Until then, from all of us here at Critical Readings, Godspeed.